This is Ellen Berkovich for Adobe Airstream Radio, and I'm happy to be here with Mark Tribe, who is an artist whose work is going to appear in Agitated Histories, a new show opening at Site Santa Fe on October 22nd. Thank you so much, Mark, for being here.
Nice to be here.
Let's start, if we could, by talking about Dystopia Files, which is one of your bodies of work that is going to be included, at least portions of it, in the show. Can you describe for us what Dystopia Files are?
Sure. A few years ago, I started collecting video clips showing police and protesters, interactions between police and protesters, mostly on streets in the U.S. I became really interested in the kind of almost ritualized performances that take place between the two groups, and so over time I assembled this archive and called it the Dystopia Files, and it contains video shot, some of it shot by myself, by me. I went to lots and lots of protests, but you know, you can't go to a protest these days without seeing a lot of video cameras. Everybody brings one. The protesters bring their cameras, the police have their cameras, and then indie media journalists and sometimes mainstream media and artists and others have their cameras. So I started collecting video that others had shot as well. I got police video mostly through lawyers who represent activists, whether they're, you know, defending themselves against charges or suing the police, as is often the case, for civil rights violations.
So what were some of the World Trade Organization protests in Seattle? Was that where all this began in 99?
Well, yeah, that's... So, you know, as I became more and more interested in the history of protest, I learned that the protests around the World Trade Organization conference in Seattle in 99 were a kind of a turning point, kind of a watershed. It was the first time that activists converged from all over the world in a really coordinated way and managed to almost shut down one of these meetings of a global organization like the World Trade Organization. The police were really taken by surprise. They ended up reacting, some would say overreacting, in fairly violently. It became known as the Battle in Seattle. And after that, the reason why it was a watershed was both because it showed protesters how effective they could be, in a sense, at garnering attention for their cause, in that case, anti-globalization. But it was also a real change in the way that protest is policed. The next big event that happened in the U.S. Happened in Miami in 2002. The name of the event is actually escaping me, but the mayor of Miami and the chief of police decided they were not going to get taken by surprise, and they created a kind of high security perimeter around the event. They deployed a massive police force in these kind of stormtrooper-like uniforms. Mm-hmm. They used what are known as less than lethal weapons, like paintballs filled with tear gas, and they hadn't yet developed the long-range acoustic devices, LRADs, these sort of sound cannons. But then they used other tactics like preemptive arrests, where basically they'll kind of close off a block and then just arrest everybody, hold them without charging them for, you know, some, the limit is usually 72 hours, and then release them. And that became known as the Miami model and was then adopted again and again around the world. And protesters then evolved their tactics to try to deal with that new kind of security culture and adopted, interestingly, a kind of security culture of their own in which they tried to prevent infiltration. Another element of the whole Miami model is police intelligence. Like the NYPD, the New York City Police Department, has one of the largest intelligence organizations in the world, larger than many nations. And they sent agents to infiltrate activist groups that were planning to protest around the 2004 Republican National Convention in New York City. And so there's this interesting kind of dance that goes on between the two sides.
Well, obviously, right now we're in the middle of the Occupy Wall Street protests growing larger, to hear the mainstream news media tell it, by the day, and growing, crossing borders, leaping borders. Yesterday was reported that Berlin and Paris and you know, when you heard the commentators describing what it reflected, there were all sorts of spins on it. But what I'm really interested in, as you're describing your art, which contains elements of activism and sociology and all kinds of things, all sorts of labels that one would put on it, without wanting to put labels on it from without, what is your stance? How do you see your art participating in these conditions of dissent? Is it another performer and the performance ritual that goes on? Is it a disinterested observer? What position are you in as the artist capturing these events?
I think I see myself more as an observer than as a participant, although I don't think it would be disingenuous to say that I'm disinterested. I mean, I tend to be sympathetic with the left-wing or progressive protesters. Although, having spent a lot of time looking at protests and the policing of protest, I do see how people on both sides of these conflicts are, to some extent, rehearsing roles or performing roles that are encoded in a certain way, and almost as if they were scripted. They wear their costumes or their uniforms. They do more or less what's expected of them. And, you know, police are human beings too. And when they commit violence against protesters, you know, they do harm to themselves as well, certainly on a karmic level, if not on a psychological level.
So your art is shown in contexts that include contemporary art halls, such as Site Santa Fe. But I also understand that you distribute it through open source networks. Can you elaborate on methods of distribution for Dystopia Files in particular?
Yeah, well, I do like the open source approach to making and sharing art and other kinds of cultural work, which, you know, one could describe as share and share alike. So, you know, in this project, the Dystopia Files, about 2/3 or maybe 3/4 of the material is stuff that I did not shoot, that people are sharing with me. And so for me to then turn around and say, no, this is mine, you can't see it without paying, or you can't make a copy of it without my permission, would be, I think, somewhat, well, problematic anyway, if not hypocritical. So I try to share and share alike. I try to make my work available online under Creative Commons licenses, which is a kind of a licensing scheme that lets people know up front that they have permission to make a copy, to remix it if they want, what kinds of purposes are allowed, commercial or non-commercial, whether or not they have to give me attribution to say from whom they're borrowing it.
This looks very different commercially, though, than, say, a very limited production of a video by Bruce Nauman that might cost $1 million or $2 million to buy.
Yeah, I was just having a conversation with someone who works with Bruce Nauman about the artist's rights management, some kind of organization, and she was suggesting that I register my images with them so that I could get royalties when people try to use my work. And I was trying to explain that I have this other kind of ideological stance. It remains to be seen if I'm ever as successful as Bruce Nauman and could stand to actually make money in that way, if I would, you know, hold to my ideals. But for now, that's where I'm at.
Well, let's also address the other performative element of your work that'll be shown, the Port Huron Project. Can you describe what that consists of?
Sure. So the Port Huron Project has a couple of different elements. First was a series of public reenactments of protest speeches that were given during the Vietnam era. So I would select a speech that was given by an activist like, say, Angela Davis or Stokely Carmichael. I looked for speeches that were given in public places like parks or city streets, and speeches where the the text of the speech or a transcription or a recording was available so that I could then find an actor to deliver the speech in that same place about 40 years later to an audience of people who I attempted to gather there. So I would, you know, put out the word, work with other organizations to try to bring an audience together to hear a speech again at the same place as it had originally been given. I documented these speeches, shot video and recorded them in different ways, and then made single channel videos, which is a art world term for basically one screen, and then also panoramic installations, multi-screen installations like the one I'm showing here at Site Santa Fe.
So when you say you bring an audience together, let me be sure that I understand what you mean. Would you actually populate the audience among people you knew, or would an audience gather because you were doing this, say, in a public place?
Well, it's hard to get 300 people to show up in a park, you know, unless you're offering free pizza or something like that. Sending out emails, posting flyers in, you know, anarchist bookshops or college campuses. So, for example, one of the reenactments was a speech originally given by Cesar Chavez, who was a Chicano civil rights and leader and labor organizer. He was the first person to successfully organize the migrant farm workers in California and possibly also New Mexico. I'm not sure. But he gave a speech in 1971 in a park in downtown L.A., and it was a speech in which he talked about the Vietnam War. It was a memorial rally for veterans who had died in Vietnam. And very powerful speech that that had been transcribed. So I got, you know, I found it in a book, actually, about Chavez's speeches. And then I worked with LACE, Los Angeles Contemporary mm-hmm. Exhibitions, which is somewhat smaller than, but similar in some ways to Site Santa Fe in Los Angeles. And they basically helped me promote the idea, promote the project, get people to come out, you know, on a Saturday afternoon to cool. hear this 40-year-old speech.
Mm-hmm. So is your work historicist?
What do you mean by historicist?
Well, I mean, are you paying homage to the moment in which the speeches were given, or are you...
I see. Yeah, another way of maybe asking the question, do you mean, like, maybe are they nostalgic in a way?
I don't really mean are they nostalgic. I mean in a sense, are they, well, I guess this is probably not even a fair comparison, but if one were to look at the work of Sherry Levine, for mm-hmm. example, and say that she's reauthored numerous works, starting with Walker Evans, Man Ray, the list goes on. She means, you know, intention is a word that I don't like applied to art, but one would say that they're definitely acts of admiration of the original.
Admiration, but also a kind of, in her case, very pointed appropriation that has to do with a questioning of authorship.
Yes.
Right?
Right.
And sort of a kind of intervention into the canon.
Yes.
So that's not really so much. I do appropriate these speeches, but my purposes are, I think, a little different. They're also different from the kinds of reenactments that one might see of Civil War battles in mm-hmm. the southern United States.
Mm-hmm.
Those, I think, and I'll admit I haven't participated in any, seem to have a nostalgic component of, you know, getting together, putting on costumes, sometimes all the way down to the wool underwear, trying to achieve a certain historical authenticity and almost time warping back into the past, you know, back to the good old days before the war. What I'm trying to do isn't so much time warp back into the past, but to bring the past into the present in a way that makes the present seem maybe a little bit less natural.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you're standing in a park in downtown Los Angeles, hearing this speech delivered by a performance artist, you know, that was given here 40 years earlier. And it's weird, you know, on the one hand, you find yourself applauding. And when you're applauding, are you applauding in solidarity with his critique of the Vietnam War? Are you applauding because you're doing a mental substitution and understanding that it's really kind of a critique of the Iraq War, or are you applauding the performance in the here and now? There's this kind of historical vertigo, maybe, that's produced by the anachronism that, you know, to speak in our theoretical terms, I think of it as a kind of Verfremdung, this term that Bertolt Brecht used that's translated sometimes as distanciation or defamiliarization. But, you know, I think we take for granted that a massive social movement like the one that people participated in 1971 is somehow impossible today. And couldn't, it's almost impossible to imagine something other than global capital, capitalism, in a way that people were able to imagine something different, a radically different future 40 years ago. So I guess this project, it's not so much trying to say, yes, we can, but more just creating a space in which people can maybe ask, why can't we, or could we?
It's very interesting to hear what you're describing. And partly, I think that one of the things that's making it, for me, something I'm really trying to wrap my head around, as well as experience, is the sense that it hasn't typically been the province of art to galvanize social movements. I mean, one could say, looking back to the early 20th century, of course, art did galvanize enormous social movements, but not quite on the scale that we're talking about of mass media. And so, to some extent, I think what I really want to ask you is being a new media artist in this way, do you see it as really an originary practice? Is it something that you're creating?
Well, when you were talking just a moment ago, I thought of Joseph Beuys, who coined the term social sculpture, who was one of the founders of the Green Party in Germany, who also started a political party for animals that I think was more hypothetical than anything else. I don't consider myself in this project, I don't consider this project, the Portrait Art Project, to be a work of social sculpture. It's not the kind of socially engaged art, to use a more contemporary term, or participatory art that's about working together with a group of people to create some different kind of social space, a different way of being together. And I think there's a lot of really interesting work going on right now in that arena. It was creating a temporary space where I think we could open up a space for questioning, but, you know, it wasn't really participatory. I mean, to a certain extent, anyone who was in the audience was participating because they were standing in the shoes of a 40-year-old audience and almost playing the role of the audience for the cameras that were there, kind of in the way that somebody who shows up at a Occupy Wall Street protest today is also performing for cameras and to some extent reenacting a notion of protest that we've received through the media. So I was also, I suppose, in the Port Huron Project trying to look at how it is protest is performed, what the role of the media is in those kinds of performances, both as how we see them. We mostly see performances on screen, not in person, but also how we perform them. We perform them for this imaginary public that's represented by cameras.
So is there sort of a gaming strategy to protest, if you've been able to contemplate whether there's actually patterns?
That's interesting. I haven't really thought that through. Another thought about reenactment as an artistic method. You know, I'm far from the only artist who's worked with reenactment. There's almost like a subgenre of reenactment art. One of the most famous examples would be the Battle of Orgreave, which was a reenactment stage by the British artist Jeremy Deller, for which he won the Turner Prize. And so he restaged this massive battle, this conflict between striking mine workers and police in the town of Orgreave in Yorkshire, I think it was. The original conflict took place in Thatcher, England in the 80s, and he got mine workers and police who were involved in the original conflict to play themselves or sometimes to switch roles. So mine workers dressed up as police and vice versa. He worked with historical reenactors who stage reenactments, which is, it's kind of a big thing in England, like restaging, for example, ancient battles. He really did it to the hilt. And he worked with a documentary filmmaker with a pretty decent budget, Mike Figgis. They made a feature-length documentary about the whole project. But there are lots of other reenactments. There's another reenactment-based project in the show Agitated Histories at Site Santa Fe that I wouldn't hazard to describe beyond that it involves restaging events from the Guatemalan Civil War, I think it was, using day laborers who gather in the parking lot of a Home Depot. What most of us who are working with reenactment are doing is playing partly with time or chronology as a medium, and it betrays in a way the different kind of topographies, I suppose, of time. The time, yes, of course, it's linear, and we can only experience really in the present, and memory is this complicated thing. But time also it folds, it loops. It's part of the predicament, I think, of this postmodern condition, to use a term that's kind of out of favor, that a relationship to the past has become really complicated. It's no longer as it was, I suppose, say for abstract expressionists, a question of innovation, like this is new, new is good, newer is better. Whereas the idea that history is this arrow that moves forward into the future and it's always progressing towards something. Instead, our relationship to the past becomes one, I suppose, of repetition in different ways.
Well, so much of what you're describing, particularly as it goes back to pertaining to surveillance, infiltration, are things that are invisible, or they're at least coded into the experience of feeling like you're seeing the pictures of what's happening, and therefore you're having a sense of the reality of what's happening. I mean, we all have the media outlets that we quote-unquote trust and those of which we're deeply suspicious, but one wouldn't necessarily say in looking at a media report, a trusted media report, a citizen might not be sitting on their couch at home saying, I'm deeply suspicious of what I'm watching on TV. I'm deeply suspicious that the size of the Tea Party or the size of Occupy Wall Street is being greatly overstated. I'm deeply suspicious that that the way that police behavior is reported is the way it's occurred. And so one of the things that I think is so fascinating about the time-based nature of the work that you are describing is that it does sound like it's setting up a camera on the cameras strategically, but it becomes, as you noted at the first, also a camera among the cameras. So at a certain point, what I like about that critically is, and I don't know if you agree with this, so I should phrase it as a question, it would appear that that would sort of demolish that typical question of what is your intention? What is the intention of your strategy?
I'm not sure. I think I actually have intention in my work, although I don't know if my intentions really overdetermine the work or completely determine what it can mean or what it can do.
Do you edit for certain? I mean, are you looking after the fact to call out things that you felt you experienced, and so therefore you're editing in order to show a moment that you think is revelatory of something that?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, so if you go onto my website, you can find the full-length videos of the reenactments. So you get every word of each speech, but you can also, if you're pressed for time, watch the 5-minute version. Mm-hmm. And of course, in the 5-minute version, I look for moments that I, think are more important than others that I choose to select. I mean, I do think that you were talking earlier about whether or not we trust or suspect media representations, how truthful or accurate we assume them to be. For the most part, whether I'm watching, Democracy Now or Fox, Democracy Now! Being the sort of left-leaning news program that's produced in New York. I tend to assume that most of the facts are accurate, that most of the things that appear on screen really happened. Although there's some interesting examples of how sometimes, like Fox News and other news outlets, will use file footage out of context. But for the most part, I think it's accurate. I think where my critical apparatus kicks in is thinking about how, you know, what is selected, what's omitted, and how the facts are interpreted too, right? So, you know, we can look at the Wall Street, Occupy Wall Street protests, and we can say they're really disorganized, they're incoherent, they don't have a clear critique, you know, they have no demands, you know, why don't they get their act together? Or we could see a group of people opening up a space for conversation that didn't otherwise exist, that are taking the time to think through problems and solutions, that maybe out of this process, new ideas can emerge. But to expect those ideas to be fully formed, you know, right at the outset seems perhaps to miss the point.
Let me ask you a final question. I know you're the founder of Rhizome.org, which has become a substantial new media community. Can you address that? Can you address the growth of a new media community in which you've been, you were really the central player in getting that underway, and how that looks today compared to...
Yeah. Well, new media is a funny term, isn't it? Because,
Very.
You know, on the one hand, it means whatever is new now. It's this kind of shifting horizon. You know, what's in the spotlight today will no longer be in the spotlight in a few years because the media won't be so new. So in that sense, you could think of it as a kind of generic term. So today, artists that do work with QR codes might be considered to be using new media, whereas an artist who makes plain Jane HTML websites that would have been considered new media in 1994, you know, maybe that's old media now. I mean, also people will sometimes refer to video art as new media art, which seems very bizarre to me since video is like 45 years old. But anyway, another way to think about new media art is as a movement that had a particular historical arc to it. And, you know, having done a little bit of research on this, I think that the term new media art really started to be used widely in 1994, which was when the web began to transform the internet into a popular medium. It was the beginning of the sort of dot-com boom and all that stuff. And then the new media art, you know, really did function as a kind of global art movement in the way that I don't think that few other... I can't think of very many other movements that existed really after the 70s. There were these sort of micro-movements in the 80s like Neo Geo, mm-hmm. and Situationism. And then I don't think you could call relational aesthetics or relational art a movement in the practices of like Liam Gillick and Rick Ritchie-Vanesia and others in the 90s. But new media art really did have all the characteristics of a movement. There were people who were working in self-conscious relationship to one another under a rubric. There were institutions, there were discourse networks, et cetera, publications. So that movement kind of peters out, as movements do, sometime between 2000 and 2003, say. The dot-com bubble burst in the spring of 2000, and within 2 or 3 years, although more artists than ever were probably working with what might count as new media, it had really been assimilated to a large extent into the mainstream art world. So, you know, for me, I was really excited about its avant-garde qualities in the mid-90s. I mean, that's why I felt it was necessary to start it. I was really turned off by the mainstream art world and wanted to kind of create a space for a kind of parallel world that would be more democratic, more bottom-up. Remarkably, yeah, it kind of, you know, rolled downhill like a snowball and grew and grew. And, you know, now I'm still involved on the board of directors, but not so much in a day-to-day basis.
But it's interesting, as if you look at the community or opportunities, you realize, wow, it's still big.
It's definitely still big, and it's less isolated. It's less ghettoized than it used to be.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Mark Traub, your work will be at SAIT Santa Fe from October 22nd to January 15th. Thank you so much for the conversation, and appreciate your being here.
Thanks for having me.